John 13, beginning at verse 1. Now before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing that his hour had come, that he would depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, and that he had come forth from God and was going back to God, got up from supper and laid aside his garment, and taking a towel, he girded himself. Then he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. So he came to Simon Peter, he said to him, Lord, do not wash my feet, or do you wash my feet? And Jesus answered and said to him, what I do you do not realize now, but you will understand hereafter. Peter said to him, never shall you wash my feet. Jesus answered him, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, then wash not only my feet, but also wash my hands and my head. And Jesus said to him, he who has bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. But you are clean, but not all of you. For he knew the one who was betraying him. For this reason he said, not all of you are clean. So when he had washed their feet and taken his garment and reclined at the table again, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, wash your feet, you ought also to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you should do as I did to you. Truly I say to you, a slave is not greater than his master, nor is one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. In this particular passage, the Apostle John is telling us about an extremely important event that takes place at the Last Supper. This is the very night in which Jesus will be betrayed. It is the night when he will be arrested and will be crucified in the morning hours. At some point during this Passover feast, Jesus gets up from the table and he lays aside his garments and he grabs a towel and he pours water into a basin and he stoops down and proceeds to wash the disciples' feet. Now let me get you into the historical context just a little bit so you understand exactly what's going on here. We wear covered shoes, socks and shoes. But in the first century world, especially in Palestine, but really in the first century Greco-Roman world, people didn't wear covered shoes like we wear. They wore open-toed shoes. And they not only wore those kind of open shoes like sandals or thongs, they also walked on dusty, dirty roads. And even if you were just in town and you were going to visit someone else to someone else's home, walk across town to their home, you would be walking these dusty, dirty roads with your open-faced shoes. And so what happens? Well, your feet get dirty. And so what was common as common courtesy that was extended to anyone who visited your home is you would offer for the person who was visiting with you to have a servant wash your feet, so that your feet could be clean. And that task of washing someone's feet, a visitor's feet, was something that the master of the house offered the visitor, but it was something that was not done by the master of the house, but it was something that was done by a servant in the house. In fact, it was the lowest of the lowest jobs. So it wasn't even a high-up servant who would do that job. It would be the lowliest of servants that would do this job. And so what Jesus is doing here on this occasion is he's washing the disciples' feet. He's doing that which was common courtesy if someone was visiting your home, but it wasn't done by the master. It was done by the lowliest of servants. Jesus is doing that which the lowliest of the lowly was doing. Of course, coming to the Apostle Peter Peter stops Jesus and just plainly refuses to allow Jesus to wash his feet. You're not going to wash my feet, are you? And so for what almost seems the very first time, we want to stand up and cheer for Peter and say, finally, he got it right at last. Finally did a good thing. You know, Peter was always the one who was impetuous and doing the speaking before he thought and doing before he thought and often got himself in trouble because he acted without thinking. And that's what we think. Finally, now he finally did a good thing. He did a good thing here. After all those blunders, when he spoke and acted impetuously, he finally gets it right. He was absolutely right. The Lord, the Master, the Messiah, the King, he ought not to wash feet. Peter felt that washing his feet would be beneath Jesus. And I think that most of us, from looking at that from the outside without seeing what goes on in the story, I think most of us would surely agree with Peter that Jesus is not the one who should be washing feet. But Jesus doesn't agree. We're kind of surprised to hear Jesus mildly rebuke Peter and saying to him, If I do not wash you, you have no part with me, in verse 8. In order for Peter to have a part in what Jesus was doing, he had to let Jesus wash his feet. What is going on here in this text? It's kind of a strange thing. There's something that's kind of interesting. I'll just share it with you a little bit. That in all of John's writings, his Greek is usually very simple. Of the various writers of the New Testament, if you were reading first century Greek, if you were reading the text in the original language, you would compare it to the other writers and you would see that John's Greek is very, very simple. It's almost, not quite this elementary, but it's almost kind of like see, spot, run Greek. Okay? In fact, John's Greek is so simple that if you're ever in a class where you're learning Greek and you get to the point where you begin to translate a text, you begin to translate not some of Paul's writings. You always start in John's writings. So I took a couple of years of Greek at Florida College when I was a student there. And when we started to translate, we started in John chapter 10. That's the first thing I ever actually translated from the original Greek language into English. Now, please understand something. Let me just be careful with you and let you know something. By the time I finished school at Florida, at the college there, I had had 2 years of Greek, and I was able to read the Greek text relatively well. In fact, well enough that when I would go to different places and hear other people preach, I oftentimes didn't take a regular Bible. I just took a New Testament Greek text. Okay. And I would follow the reading or follow the preaching in the Greek text. But don't be fooled into thinking that that means that I know Greek. I do not know Greek. And I will tell you that my second year of Greek was important to me because it was my second year of Greek that taught me that I didn't know Greek. In fact, my second year of Greek taught me that in my first year of Greek, I learned enough Greek to be dangerous to myself and to other people. Okay? So I don't know Greek. I'm not trying to say that I know Greek. But it is very interesting that John's writing is very, very simple. And it's pretty elementary. But then suddenly as we're reading along, if we were reading in the original language, suddenly we come to this section. It even is surprising in the English text because we're kind of surprised because we come to the beginning of chapter 13, verses 1 through 4, and suddenly we have something, a sentence that is considerably more complex than we're kind of used to seeing in John's writing. This almost run-on sentence, which is verses 1 through 4, I know the New American Standard Version actually breaks it up into two verses, but it's actually really just one long verse. Now, this run-on sentence, really just one sentence, this run-on sentence stops us and makes us wonder what's going on here. And I believe that it's intended to stop us, to make us stop and reflect on what's being told us in these texts. The reason we have to stop and look at this, the reason John wants us to stop a minute and think about what he's saying is because he gives us information in this long sentence that is really quite critical to understanding what Jesus is doing in this text here. So what does this section of text tell us about what Jesus is about to do? Or why is it important that we know the things that are revealed in these verses as we look at this text? Well, I want you to notice what he talks about. He tells us that even before the Passover meal began, Jesus knew what time it was. He knew that it was almost time, the time had come for him to depart out of this world. This text tells us that. He knew that before this day was over, the text says in verse 13, chapter 13, verse 1, now before the feast of the Passover, Jesus, knowing that the hour had come for him to depart out of the world, Jesus knew that it was time for him to do what he ultimately came here to do, and that's to die for the sins of the world. He knew that before this day was over, if you reckon time the way Jews reckon time, that before this day was over, he would be dead. That this was going to be a difficult and deadly day because he would be executed on a Roman cross before this day was over. It was time for him to leave. And so the sentence tells us that Jesus knows the time has come. But it also tells us about the fact that Jesus loved his own who were in the world and that he loved them to the end, according to verse 1. And so what the text is telling us is that to the bitter end, Jesus would love his own. Now, when we think about his own, maybe we're thinking about his disciples. Maybe we're thinking about the 12 apostles. Maybe we're thinking about disciples in a broader sense. But I would suggest that in the context of John's gospel, that maybe his own is even broader than his disciples. Because I remember in the prologue of John, in John chapter 1, beginning in verse 10, the text says that he was in the world and the world was made through him and the world did not know him. He came to his own and those who were his own did not receive him, but as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become the children of God, even those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood nor of the will of the flesh, nor the will of man, but of God. Notice, he came to his own. In this context, his own is a reference to humanity. He came to those whom he had created, those whom he had been a part of in making in the very beginning. So he comes to his own, and it tells us that, John tells us that he loved these who were his own. He came to those, to people, and he loved those people to the bitter end. The sentence also tells us that Jesus knew exactly what kind of authority he had. It says that he knew that the Father had given all things into his hand, verse 3. He knew that he had all authority, and he would ultimately say that in Matthew 28, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. He knew what kind of authority he had. He also knew about his divine origin, where he had come from, that he had come forth from God, verse 3. He also knew about his divine destiny, that he was going back to the Father, according to verse 3. We're told that Jesus knows exactly who he is. He knows where he came from. He knows where he's going to. He knows what kind of authority he has. And the point is that someone with this kind of authority, with this kind of divine origin and divine destiny, that one should not be the one, in that culture especially, that one should not be the one to wash feet. He would be the last one that we would think of that would stoop down and wash people's dirty feet. But we're not done yet. The sentence isn't over. Because there's at least one more very important thing that we're told in this text, that this text reveals to us. It says, tells us specifically that Judas was there during the supper of the devil, verse 2, having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, to betray him. Jesus knowing, what his father had given him. The point is, John goes out of his way to tell us that treacherous Judas, the one who we know from earlier in the text or other gospels, had already by this point made the dirty deal to deliver Jesus over, to betray Jesus. That guy is sitting at that table. He's reclined at the table with Jesus here. And the point is that Jesus washes even the feet of this one who was his enemy. Jesus washed Judas' feet too, the text tells us. Sure, he would wash the feet of those who initially forsook him. Yes, those apostles initially forsook him. But they later repented and they later would become the ones who would take his gospel message to the world. But he also washed the feet of Judas, his ultimate enemy, the one who betrayed him. And the one who betrayed him and felt so guilty about it that he went out and hanged himself in order to put himself out of his misery. Jesus washed not just the feet of his inferior friends. Jesus also washed the feet of his enemies. He washed Judas' feet. So that long run-on sentence gives us that kind of information. So we know a little bit of, got a little bit of a backdrop of what's happening here. And of course, when this humiliating task was finished, Jesus orders his disciples to follow his example. There in verse 12, so when he had finished, when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and reclined at the table again, he said to them, "Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, wash your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you should do as I did to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a slave is not greater than his master, nor is one who sent greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do these things." Jesus says that what I've done, I want you to follow the example that I've given you. Now, I need to say something that I think ought to be obvious. When Jesus tells them that he wants them to follow the example he has now set, he was not ordering them to have a foot washing service. I'm just going to tell you, if you think that that's what Jesus is saying, is what I want you to do now is I want you to make sure that ever so often, maybe whenever you come together and eat the Lord's Supper, whenever you do this, I want you to take the time to have a foot washing service and wash one another's feet. If you think that's what the text is saying, it's just gone right over your head. You've just missed the point. Okay? And that ought to be obvious to us, first of all, by the question that Jesus asks in verse 12. He just finishes washing their feet, and then he says to them, "Do you know what I've done to you?" That would be like me walking up to Neil. Pretty big dude. If you ever see him stand up next to me, he's bigger than I. He's not as buff as I am, but he is he's a pretty tall fellow. Okay? And I walk up to Neil and I whack him in the face and then I say, "Do you know what I just did to you, Neil?" And he says, "Yeah, let me show you." And he'll probably whack me right back. Okay? Obviously, Jesus wasn't asking them to answer, "Yes, Jesus, you have set the example of washing feet, and so we're going to have a foot washing service." That's not what Jesus was trying to get at. Jesus' question is actually asking them to look deeper into what has just been done and see the message that this action on his part provides for them. It forces them to look at what Jesus was trying to show them. Think about what I'm trying to demonstrate to you by this lowly act of service. I would suggest that Jesus is teaching us here that we must stoop to serve not just our friends, not just those who are our peers, but those who, in our own imagination, may be lower than us. In fact, Jesus is teaching us that we must even wash the feet or serve those who are our enemies. I think maybe if the president were here, or some famous celebrity that you kind of looked up to, maybe some big football player or baseball player that you had great admiration for, if that was the person here, maybe some of us would stoop to wash their feet to serve such a person as that. But Jesus didn't stoop here to wash the feet of those who were his superior. I think if Jesus was here himself, would you be willing to wash his feet? Would you be willing to actually take water and wash his dirty feet? I think all of us would say, yeah, he's the Lord. Of course I would wash his feet. But that's not what Jesus is teaching us to do. Jesus isn't teaching us to wash the feet of our superiors. He's not even asking us to wash or teaching us to wash the feet of those who are simply our peers. Jesus, by his action, is asking us, actually he's showing us that we must wash the feet of our inferiors, and not even just the feet of those who we think of as our inferiors, but that we must even wash the feet of those who are our enemies. We must serve those who are even our enemies. In truth, the action that Jesus, in this act of Jesus, he shows us what the Bible has always really been trying to tell us about the nature of our God. God has always been the one who stoops to serve, who reaches down to serve those under him. In fact, even those who are his enemies. Do you remember what Paul says in Romans chapter 5? Romans 5, beginning at verse 6. For while we were still helpless at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And as sinners, he will later describe us, because we are sinners, we are enemies of God. We are at enmity with him. And yet, what did God do? We're not the ones who reached up to God and said, God, save us. God, do something to help us. No. But while we were in rebellion, while we were shaking our fist in his face, he decided to, in his love, to stoop down and reach down to save us, to act on our behalf. He sent his son to die for us. Jesus, in stooping to wash the disciples' feet, is imitating his Father. He's showing us what God is really all about. That God is the one who stoops to serve even his enemies. Us, who were lower, not just lower, but in fact were his enemies. Later in John chapter 13 and in verse 34, Jesus is going to give us an example or another command. In verse 34, he says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Jesus is telling us a new commandment here, to love one another. We might ask the question, what's so new about that? Because hasn't the law always said, love your neighbor as yourself? Go back to Leviticus 19. By the way, if you've never walked through Leviticus 19, you ought to take the time to look at that passage. Really good passage to look at. Hasn't God always told us that we're supposed to love one another? The new part, I believe, in this commandment is that we are to love one another even as I have loved you. God is asking us, the Lord is asking us to duplicate his love for us in the way we love one another. To love my neighbor as myself, well, that's equal to loving my equal. That means I love my equal. I love my peer. Jesus wants us to love differently. He wants us to love like he loved. He loved not simply his equal. He stooped down to love his inferior. And in fact, even more than that, he stooped to love his enemy. And we must love like that. To love those who love us, Jesus had said earlier in the Sermon on the Mount, well, that's no better than worldly people do, essentially. In Matthew chapter 5, when Jesus is teaching on this in the Sermon on the Mount, he says in verse 43, you have heard it said that you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be the sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors and sinners do the same? If you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you are to be perfect just as your heavenly Father is perfect. God calls us to do something much more than just what normal, average, ordinary, typical people will do. Even tax collectors and Gentiles love those who love them. God is asking us to love like he loves. He's asking us to love and to serve even those who are our enemies. And I want you to understand, folks, that that's what people are supposed to see about us pretty quickly. Jesus doesn't say in this text, by all the right doctrines, people will know that you are my disciples. We have some unique, some special, some different than most religious people. We have some unique teachings that we believe the Bible teaches and calls upon us to follow. And they're important, and we need our friends in the world, people who are lost, need to understand those things, need to understand those teachings. And we want to be able to share those teachings with others. But as unique and as important as those messages are, Jesus doesn't say that that's how people will know that you're my disciples. The first way in which they should know that you are his disciples is by the way you have, the relationships you have with one another. Listen to me, I am very strong in my understanding or in my interest in teaching people what God wants us to do. And I know that there are things that we believe from the scriptures that are not believed or taught in denominational churches. And I want desperately to help my denominational friends to see the truth of those things. But what is going to get their attention? What is going to help them understand that? The first thing that they need to see is that we're people who care about each other and them. And that's what's going to make them more interested in listening to us. That's why we made a plea, for example, on Friday night, to be people who are like Jesus in terms of being compassionate to those who are in the world and who are lost and broken. They need to see us as people who love other people. They need to see that we have unique relationships with one another. They need to see that, those people really love each other. What makes them so much in love with one another? What makes them live like that? And now we are going to have the opportunity to share with them those important teachings that they need to hear in order to have authentic salvation through Jesus Christ. But sometimes, because of how distant we are from one another, they come into our assemblies and they don't see anything unique about our relationships. And because they don't see anything unique about who we are in terms of our relationship with one another, they have a hard time hearing the unique message that we're preaching. Jesus is asking us to love differently. He's not asking us to love like the world loves. He wants us to love one another like he loved us. And that love is an active thing which is willing to stoop to serve even those who are not always so lovable. I will be honest with you and tell you that sometimes some of my brothers are a little hard to love. Some of my brothers are really different from me. And they act differently and they react differently and they have their own personalities. And sometimes they're difficult. And especially if they're not yet very far along in the process of being renovated after the image of Christ, their lives are different. And sometimes it's hard to love them. But Christ calls upon me to love them. And to love them in such a way that when people see me interacting, even with that brother who's difficult, people will say, those folks are really disciples of Jesus. Jesus is asking us to love in an active way, love one another in an active way like he loved, which is to love not just the ones of my brothers that I get along with, not the ones that I always dislike. There's some of you that I really like to hang with, but there may be others among us that we don't really like to hang with, but we love each other anyway. And so we don't just love the ones who love us or the ones who are easy to get along with. We love each other, all of each other. Even that brother who's a little awkward. Or that brother who's a little eccentric. Or that brother who's a little sharp with his words. Or that brother who's not always very sensitive about other people. Or that brother who sometimes seems to keep finding fault with me. I must love him anyway. Jesus, I must serve him anyway. And that's what Jesus is calling us to do, is to love in that unique sort of way. He's asking us to love even those who are our enemies. Even those who we're a little bit concerned about getting too close to because we might get infected by whatever it is that they've got. There's their spiritual sins, their spiritual wrong that they're doing. Those people that we see are broken, we love them anyway. Let me just say this, that if you're looking for a Christianity that will let you stay in your comfort zone, if you're looking for a Christianity, a form of Christianity that will allow you to stay in your comfort zone, you won't find it in authentic New Testament Christianity. That's not what Jesus offers. Jesus holds before us, he offers us a form of following him that consistently puts us out of our comfort zone, sometimes way out of our comfort zone. And if you're unable to handle that, then you simply cannot be a disciple of Jesus. Following Jesus means that we follow his example. We must stoop to serve and to love those who we may imagine to be beneath us. Those who are not as lovable as we would like them to be. It means that we must stoop to serve and love those we think of as our inferiors. Those, we don't really have inferiors, but those who we may think are beneath us, and we even love our enemies. Those who consistently hurt us, even. We love them anyway. It is the height of arrogance, I believe, to think that we would want him to serve us, to love us, and to save us from our sins. But then we're too good to stoop and serve the lowly, the orphan, the widow, the homeless, the sinner, those who are our enemies. How can I think that Jesus would want to save me or should want to save me and serve me by giving his life for me if I'm not willing to serve others who make my life difficult too? And so I would just say this, that if we can humble ourselves to gladly and eagerly do that, to stoop to serve even those who are our enemies, then we will be more like Jesus. And if we are unwilling to do that, then just like Peter, we can have no part with Jesus. Please understand that what we've been talking about, this matter of loving one another, loving even our enemy, stooping to serve even those who we see as beneath us or those who we don't or those who are our enemies, this is not an optional thing. It's not an optional thing. We sit here in our nice clothes, our comfortable building, and we have all these nice things in our lives, and we have it really, really good. I don't see a person in this room who isn't richly blessed by God. If we can't come out of our comfort zone and serve people who don't have what we have, who aren't as squeaky clean as we are trying to be, those who sometimes don't do the things that are helpful to us, but do the things that are hurtful to us, if we can't do that, if we can't love those people, then we can have no part with Jesus. That's just the facts. And I recognize that, like you, I sometimes get turned off by folks. I sometimes have folks that are difficult, who I sometimes think to myself, I sure wish that guy would go to a different congregation. I let that terrible thought enter my head. Instead of remembering to pray, Lord, help me to help this brother. Don't let him go away. Help me. Let me be the one. Keep him here so that I can be the one. I can help him to be a better man or a better person. I know that we get tired and we see things like that and we want people. We just want to be done with that guy. But we can't be like that, because that's not the way our master was. And we want to be like Jesus. Being like Jesus is doing this kind of stuff. Okay? It's what being like Jesus is about. Taking care of people who are broken and who are not very lovable. Stooping to serve even them. If we can help you in some way to be more like Jesus, if we can encourage you in some way to be more like Jesus, if you've not yet even put Jesus on and you not yet are one of his servants, if we can help you obey the gospel, if you need information about who this Jesus is and how you can come to serve him and what he can do for you in terms of salvation and how you might access that, if you need information like that, let us know that. We'll be happy to sit down with you this very day and talk with you about that. Because we want your salvation just like our Lord wants your salvation, because we're trying to be like him. So if we can help you in any way, let us do it while we stand and sing with Josh.